Okay, so this is the problem I want to talk about. I want to talk about what happens if you take the standard Navier-Stokes equation. This is a classical problem, by the way. Everybody knows this problem. And what happens as viscosity goes to zero? The important thing here is that I have a boundary. If you don't have a boundary, then we were told yesterday, Edmund and Marsden proved this, that this is going to converge to that if the solution is smooth. Yeah, but they have a right. Okay, so there's always this problem because this problem here has two boundary conditions. This problem here has only one boundary condition. Right? So there seems to be a problem, and this is what's understood by Prandtl. In principle, Prandtl says that there's a boundary layer, and says in the boundary layer, the things behave differently, and so Prandtl proceeded to derive what happens in the boundary layer. And that's Prandtl's boundary layer equation. Oops. Space is not enough here. So let me show you the Prandtl boundary layer equation. So this is Prandtl's boundary layer equation. So the basic idea is that, so suppose this is your boundary. Suppose this is a solid boundary. There is some boundary layer here of thickness square root of epsilon. Epsilon is the viscosity. Here you basically should solve Euler. And here you should solve Prandtl. And this should be a nice description of Navier-Stokes. The main simplification of Prandtl's equation, which I wrote here, is that you get pressure. Pressure is the hard part in Navier-Stokes. You get pressure from the Euler. So that's the main simplification. So this is the unsteady Prandtl, and people also talk about a steady Prandtl for reasons that I don't really understand. But in the engineering literature, it's very popular to talk about steady Prandtl with time is taken out. So you're supposed to think of the following. So here you have some inflow. Pardon me?
I was saying
the synthesis, but I don't understand the dynamics. You don't understand that at all?
Right,
I don't understand it either, so it's not a problem. I cannot help very much. So here's the steady Prandtl. So suppose the flow comes in like this, then you have some velocity profile. So I'm plotting the velocity profile in the horizontal direction. So this is how big the velocity is. And then you solve Prandtl further along in the x direction. So this is the steady Prandtl. So questions are, obviously, whether the Prandtl equations are well posed. And secondly, whether the Prandtl equation has a finite time singularity formation, which should be related to the separation of boundary layers. And thirdly, what happens, is it true that Navier-Stokes really converge to Euler plus Prandtl? So what I'm going to do, okay, this problem is understood in two cases. One is if the data are analytic, then everything is proved, that the Prandtl equations are well posed. This is not proved, but you can also prove that Navier-Stokes converged to Euler plus Prandtl, and this is the result of Sammartino and Kaflisch. So, and then, in some of the compressible case, so I put a quotation mark here. So this, by this I mean harmonic conservation laws, where you add strong viscosity. Then you can show this picture. You can show this is true. In that case, the boundary equation looks very different. So the problem we're talking about is really different. Now, but even there, what happens is that everybody's proved all the non-physical problems have this feature, and nobody's looking at any physical problems. For example, if you talk about 1D compressible Navier-Stokes, there's no result, even for smooth solutions. Sort of a little bit embarrassing, but no one has looked at it. So what I'm going to do for my talk is that I'm going to give you a supersonic review of the mathematical results, and then I'm going to talk about a numerical experiment, which shows that maybe there's something complicated. Maybe there is a reason why some of these problems are not really understood. And I'm not working very well here, as you can see. Okay. Pardon me? There are seven theorems you have to know if you're really serious about the subject. So let me tell you what the seven theorems. Two theorems due to Olenek, which says the following. For the steady and unsteady Prandtl equation, if nothing interesting happens, then you have a smooth solution. You have a strong solution for her time. For example, for the state equation, she proves the following, that if your pressure gradient goes this direction, if your flow goes that direction, and your pressure gradient also drives in that direction, she proves that you have a global solution. And she also has a result, analogous result for the unsteady case. If everything is monotonic, you don't expect to have blow up, you don't expect to have separation of boundary layers, then everything is fine. So these are two results of Olenek. At the time, they were spectacular results. Okay, so these are the nice situation. Two theorems already. So, two theorems about blow up. First, in the steady situation, suppose you have adverse pressure gradient. Pressure gradient runs against you. What's going to happen? This problem is understood many, many years ago. What's going to happen is that somewhere you have separation of boundary layers. So here, that your velocity field, if you plot the velocity field, it looks like this. Namely, the derivative u of y vanishes at the point, and then beyond which you cannot talk about the boundary layer equation. So this is what u y incidentally is the vorticity at the wall. It's also the shear stress at the wall. So that's the idea of separation, that if the shear stress vanishes at the wall, it's a signal for separation. And locally over here, people have done local analysis of the blow-up. This is called the Goodstein-Stewardson singularity, which predicts some scaling. And that scaling looks like the following. So the local velocity profile looks like such a thing. So it vanishes. X star is the point of separation. And this picture is also justified to a large extent by the result of Caporelli and myself. So we proved that under some conditions, so if you have a pressure gradient right here, and then there is indeed a point of separation beyond which you cannot define solutions. Solutions cannot be extended beyond that point. And also the separations obeys the scaling predicted by this analysis. There's some subtleties left, which I'm not going into, So there is, so this is the blow up of steady boundary layer. There is also a result on the blow up of unsteady boundary layer. That's due to Anquist and myself. What happens, so you don't have to read this slide. Let me just describe to you the picture. I just said that steady blow up is signaled by the vanishing of shear stress. For a long time, that's what people thought. That's what separation of boundary layers is about. That's when I learned when I was a graduate student at UCLA taking courses in the engineering department. This is not the case for unsteady blow-up. Unsteady blow-up happens by essentially formation of shocks. The nonlinearity in the Prandtl equation, which I've taken out, Prandtl equation has a nonlinearity. And that term really does the job. And at the blow up, the vertical velocity, that's the velocity going this direction, goes to infinity. So the blow up does not happen at the wall. It happens somewhere here. And at that point, velocity goes to infinity. So this is the result proof. That's what the proof of, and I'll show you that's what's happening in reality. So, but if you read the theorem carefully, what we said is that there are no global strong solution. We did not prove that there is a local solution. So two things could happen. One is that you cannot even talk about local solutions. The other thing is that if there is a local smooth solution, that smooth solution has to blow up. So here's my challenge to Edris. He said yesterday that giving him an equation, he's giving a local existence result. Here's my equation. I'm expecting by the time I visit you again, which is on Monday, you give me the local existence result. Pardon me? This is not the backwarding heat equation. This equation, the Prandtl equation, you can compute, you can refine your backward equation, you can hardly compute, right? You can take a finite difference scheme, like Sprengel scheme, you can compute, refine the grid, you get nice solutions. So it's not the... He said local existence, actually. Okay, I went this much detail just to present you this problem, so you have to do something. So this is my this is the four theorems about Prandtl. Now there are three theorems left. The three theorems are concerning convergence problem. Okay, so I said that the conventional picture is that you have Navier-Stokes converge to Euler plus Prandtl. Is this right? Now, right now we only have bad news. And so first of all, if you expect this boundary layer expansion to be valid, then you actually expect these kind of estimates. Not only that the convergence, there's some sort of estimate involved. Right now we only have bad news. The bad news is that Grenier proved that if there's such a theorem, it must be very hard to prove. What he proved here is that you can take these boundary layer profiles, you can perturb it in you can add arbitrarily small perturbation in arbitrarily higher sublevel norm, and arbitrarily short time, they're going to deviate. So the boundary layer problem is extremely unstable. That's what the theorem says. Okay. Later on, I can give you intuition. All these theorems are not so hard to prove in some sense. Some of them are actually hard to prove, I'm sorry. but this is the content of the theorem, that the problem is extremely unstable. Now, Kato proved the following result. So now we've changed the subject. Now we're not talking about convergence to Prandtl plus Euler. We just talk about convergence to Euler. So in some sense, we have to change the norm. Before, we were talking about uniform convergence. The error has to go to zero uniformly. Now, since we're giving up describing the details of boundary layer, so we only take the L2 norm, mean square average. Kato says the following, that Navier-Stokes converge to Euler if and only if energy dissipation rate goes to zero. And that, in turn, is equivalent to saying that the energy dissipation rate in the strip with epsilon goes to zero. It's a very simple proof, just by trying to massage something, take the Euler, massage, connect it to the boundary, to satisfy the boundary condition, and then the matching gives you this. What's astonishing about this result is that he's not talking about the boundary layer width. The gamma epsilon here is not the boundary layer width. Boundary layer width is square root of epsilon. He's talking about much thinner layer. So something violent must be happening in that very thin region in order not to have convergence from Navier-Stokes to Euler. Now, incidentally, I should mention that many people don't believe that there is convergence of Euler, Navier-Stokes to Euler. If you look at the pictures in Van Dyck's book, the wakes are really finite size, and they're really turbulent. You don't believe it's Euler there. You really believe there has to be Reynolds stress, has to be important there. Yes? Yeah, well, in 2D, it's, yes. Well, this is dissipation. It is a dissipation. Okay, so... I said dissipation. It is a dissipation.
No, you mean by dissipation on the
state. Oh, okay. That I didn't even realize. Sorry. So the only clean statement in the subject is the following problem, is the following result. Masmoudi says that if we change the problem, if we talk an anisotropic viscosity, then you have convergence of Navier-Stokes to Euler if the horizontal viscosity, if this viscosity in this direction is much larger viscosity in that direction. So this tells you what's the difficulty of the problem. Controlling variation in the horizontal direction is actually the hard part. So here he says if I put much more viscosity in that direction, then I have convergence. It's again a very simple proof, but this is the only statement, the clean statement in the subject. So now you know all seven theorems. So, in the second part of the talk, I'm going to talk about numerics. And I'm going to talk, I really want you to think of...
Comment on what you said about the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Get any sort of structure like that, you have to have gone through some sort of phase where there's been a lot of reconnection and other types of vortex dynamics like that.
Mm-hmm.
Not the oil.
Mm-hmm.
I can't about things like that and being able to talk about higher limits of routines and taking it to the zero viscosity limits and doing oil, that just doesn't make sense to me. On the other hand,
so do you
just for finite time from any given initial condition that probably could show emergence and not be shown from oil.
That's a good point. Yes, I agree. I agree. So you're talking about statistical equilibrium or versus the initial value problem. Yes, that's a good point. And here, let me just, for clarification here, I'm strictly talking about initial value problem, finite time. That's a very good point. That's, I was going to talk about that in the, at the end of my talk, but yes. Yeah, I agree. That's has also has something to do with your comment, just the comment just made. So I really want you to think of this as an experiment. So I'm going to describe to you my experimental tool, which is a numerical method, right? So I'm going to use this vorticity formulation, and if I don't know how many of you know this stuff, but there's been a huge amount of discussion about numerical methods of vorticity formulation. The problem is that we don't have a boundary condition for vorticity. No boundary condition for vorticity. And there's tons of papers. And if you look at, say, the 74 review article of Ozag and Israeli and 92 review article of Grayshaw, both published in Annual Review of Fluids, then you realize these guys in the field have a really tough life because it's really confused. And here I'm saying that the problem is really simple. All you have to do is do the following things. And you take central difference, and then you take local vorticity boundary condition. I can write them down, but... Huh? What is what? Local vorticity boundary condition? You really want me to write down? So I'll give you one example. Everybody sees? So suppose you're a grid here. And you want to compute the vorticity here at the boundary. So what you do is, this is the earliest formula called Thom's formula. 2 over h squared, where h is the size of the grid, and phi, which is the stream function, 1j. So this is the phi, 1j. So all we have to do is do this. That's called Thom's formula. That's a local evaluation. Once you know the phi, you know the omega. And then you just take some convectively stable time step. This is a terrific method.
So initially, the boundary conditions are carried by the initial data, so your phi 1j is given times 0.
Phi, no, one is, this is the one, okay. Sorry, this should be I1. This is the I squared point, 0 line, 1, this is the first line. That's right. At each time step, you would have
the boundary and inside. So you need
yeah.
The
beauty of the thing is, the zero here is this zero. It's not time zero.
Not
I put. Where is my chalk? Okay, this is n time n time n. The beauty of this is that you're saying, okay, I need to know this to compute this. Beauty of the method, which I'm not putting here, is that when you compute this, this is already known. At each time step, there's a nice procedure. It's not the initial data, it's the...
How do you know
it's the start? Initially you have the initial data, but at a later time, you have the phi at that time. Of course, everything comes from initial data. No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, you probably, if you talk about... Okay, anyway. Yeah. 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 Okay. Anyway, this idea was we had this paper written in '94. At the time, this looked so simple, and we're so shy about this. We didn't say this was a method. We just said, okay, this is something we're going to analyze this method. And then right now, I mean, after 7 years, I'm willing to make a statement that this was actually a new method. And I spent 7 years trying to understand why people didn't do this before. And I sort of understand a little bit now. But there are some reasons why they didn't do this before. And as far as 2D is concerned, you cannot beat this one. This is such a stable, efficient, accurate, and most importantly, simple method that I can write a code. As a matter of fact, the first code we wrote, I wrote it. I'm proud to say. Pardon me? Thank you. Thank you. But this is the second order method. What we really use is the fourth order method. And this fourth order method also has a very nice feature, which is that it's made out of second order operators, which means everything you have on second order operators, you can use for this fourth order method. And it's indeed fourth order method. We can prove this fourth order method. Okay, so much for my commercial, for the method.
Can you do it 3D?
Yeah, you can do it 3D. But I would say, we have a paper on 3D, but I would say we don't have as much experience in the 2D, so I don't want to make that such a claim. But in principle, we can do it in 3D. It works. And, no. Same thing. Okay, since I'm describing experiments, I have to check my experiments really works as it should be, right? So, we don't really have an exact solution. So in the absence of an exact solution, how do you make sure your method works? How do you make sure that what you computed is what's supposed to be? And we do it in the most dumb way, which is that we define the grid, right, and compare the different solutions. So this is the Reynolds number. So right, okay, sorry, I didn't tell you what the problem is. The problem is flow past cylinder, impulsively started. That's the problem. So what I'm just showing you is that you do what's called grid resolution, refinement, convergence study. So you take different pictures, and then you compare them, and they look the same. To show you that they really look the same, they really look the same. These are three different grids at Reynolds number 50,000. Different? No, we didn't. Okay. So I've shown, Yeah. Yes. Okay, I've shown you the good part. So this is the drag. So from the pictures, you wouldn't see how the difference. That's what I'm saying. From pictures, you wouldn't. So then if you look at the drag, these are same problem, the drag coefficient with three different resolutions. So here you sort of expect it's a little bit of a problem because we're doing impulsive start. Initial condition is really singular. But here, right around this time, which is actually exactly the separation time, you also see some problem. And let me show you the nature of the problem. So if you blow that up, you'll see that the coarse grid does not do such a good job in computing the drag coefficient. Okay, but well, they're not so bad, right? If you look at the green and the blue, okay, they're not so bad. I mean, I agree they're not exactly on top of each other, but it's certainly compared with this, it's much better. Pardon me? Yeah. I mean, if I could, you know, these are numerics, I can always plotted in such a way that there is some error. It's not going to be exactly on top of the other. So let me now show you a different comparison, which is a comparison with the industry standards. What's the current standards? The standards of that, of the same problem. So this is the result of Tony Leonard at Caltech with his student. So this is not very, we're not doing justice to him because we just downloaded this from his homepage, the picture. This is using the vortex method. So, considering, pardon me? Same boundary condition, but they're doing this exact, what do you, Moskalek? Moskalek type of, so are you asking about the random walk part, or?
No, I was asking about, well.
Boundary condition is the same. We're doing exactly the same problem.
You know how they implement it?
They implement the vortex method. With the diffusion done in a different way, not random walk, but rather doing this heat kernel. Greens function thing. So that's very. Okay, I couldn't pronounce the name. Sorry. So, Okay. I said, but was he in the student of Leonard?
Sorry?
He was a student, right? Of Tony. Okay, so that part wasn't so wrong. That part. Okay. So considering it's a vortex method, this actually, so this is the comparison with our method, with what we did, and at the same time. So considering it's a vortex method, that actually works remarkably well. I was surprised that the thing that really did so well. And let me just show another picture. This is at a later time. And comparing it with, if you look at it, certainly it doesn't have as much details as this one, but all the main features are reproduced. Where are my slides? What it doesn't do so well, by now we have learned, right? It's tougher to talk about drag coefficient. So at a lower Reynolds number, 3,000, the dashed line is theirs, the solid line is ours. At the lower Reynolds number, it doesn't do so badly. But in higher Reynolds number, after separation, it starts to deviate. Since we've done such a careful job verifying our result, I like to claim that his accuracy is not so good here. Okay, so this is a comparison with industry standards. So now, what about the results for this problem? There are three critical times that you have to know about flow path cylinder. The first critical time, so let's draw a flow path cylinder. So this is a cylinder, and flow goes like this, right? Okay, the first critical time is that the flow, shear stress starts to vanish at the wall. Remember, that was the signal for steady separation. So shear stress vanishes at the wall, which means that you have a backflow coming out this way. So this is the first critical time. So let me just show you a picture of that. Now, nothing dramatic happens, as you'll see. So the first critical time is a boring time. So you have a backflow. This color is the sort of a backflow. The boundary layer is still not separating. It's still with the boundary. And people have done this thing, have studied this time before. Oops. Okay, so this is, if you look at the first critical time as a function of Reynolds number, and that's the curve you have. So as I say, people have done this before and realized they more or less agree that the 0.35 probably is the right number. So here we just have to give you a much more accurate result. Second critical time is the boundary layer separation time. So let me just, before I talk about what happens after separation, just give you this picture of the time. Now, so this is the time, second critical time, which is, I'm going to say, the boundary layer separation time, as a function of Reynolds number. And this fit comes from all these data points which are verified. And we have this data point, which is 200,000, that our computer budget doesn't allow us to verify the result. Indeed, this, if you look at the picture, which is posted on the homepage of Hans, by the way, I forgot to mention, really important thing, that the calculations, most of the calculations were done by Hans Johnston, who was a student of J.G. Liu. And the work at the numerical method I described earlier is a joint work with them. All my work on the area is joint work with them. So Hans really made all these calculations and did a really great job, really careful, thorough. So this data point, all these data points are verified in the way that I told you that we do grid refinements and check, and this one is not. And you can see that it's sort of a little bit off. Okay, so what happens at the separation? So before separation, if you do the scaling, boundary layer kind of scaling, and look at different Reynolds number, everything fits on top of each other. So here we plot three different Reynolds number, 100K, 50K, huh? Okay, so this is vorticity. This is, if you cut an angle, I think it's 22.5. If you cut an angle like that, you plot the vorticity profile on that line. Yeah, zero being here, right here at the at the cylinder. This is three different Reynolds numbers properly scaled according to boundary layer theory. So this is before separation. I'll give you a couple more of these pictures. This is a later time, but still slightly before separation. The boundary layer scaling still works. Everything still collapses on each other, collapses on top of each other at a different angle. Okay? Now, this is at separation, or close to separation. Then you can see it doesn't work anymore. Okay? So what happens at separation? So before separation, what I'm plotting here is the radial velocity, the velocity that goes away from the boundary. At an early time, this is how it looks. At a later time, the radial velocity has increased by at least a factor of 10 at the separation. So this is not a proof, not a computer-assisted proof, certainly. But it's, I actually have the other pictures which shows that the vertical velocity, the radial velocity, is going to be very big at the separation. So this is pretty much what you would have expected, right? So among the things that probably you would not have expected, I'm going to explain you two things. So two things that you probably have not expected. Yes? Yeah, it's a transient event. I'm not talking about a statistical steady state. I'm always going to be talking about a transient event. I'm going to show that, but it depends on time or so. You mean the position, the angle? The angle? It's hard to define. Yeah, you mean which angle it separates, right? That's hard to define. That's hard to define because it's not clear where you call it a separation angle. Okay, that I'm showing it later. By the way, I thought I just explained that's not the right signal for unsteady separation. That the shear stress vanishes. No, separation, well, we can talk about this later. But I hope I've convinced you that before the second critical time, T2, the boundary layer scaling works very well. It's really after T2 the boundary layer scaling becomes bad. So I like to call T2 the separation time rather than T1. T1 is the time where recirculation starts. T1 is 0.3, whereas T2 is 1.4, much later. T2 is, okay, I'll tell you that just a bit later. Yeah, when I show the next picture, you go. So there are two sets of things I want to tell you. The first is the scaling. What's the scales in this problem? First, obviously, there is a boundary layer scale, which is square root of epsilon, in which, and if you look at that, vorticity goes like, so if you do that, so let's, and vorticity would go like square root of Reynolds number. So that's boundary layer scaling predicts that. So here's a time scale of the maximum vorticity, a time history of maximum vorticity at different Reynolds number, scaled by Reynolds number to the half. Before separation, it works very well. After separation, you can see the higher the Reynolds number, the higher the curve. So certainly this is not doing well. After separation, it's not scales as Reynolds to the half. T2, okay, you want to do T2. I'll give you your T2. Forgot to bring T2. Sorry. No. T2. So you want to know T2. No. I want to show you the picture. I'm going to say everything precisely. So this is the picture where I plotted as time and angle all the points where the shear stress vanishes. So this is a T1. That's the first point where the shear stress vanishes. That curve here, this nice curve here is the T1. That's the first point where the shear stress vanishes. T2 is this point. I'm defining T2 according to the second. Yes, you're right. No, this is the first time. This is the second time where the shear stress vanishes. Yes, it's coincide. Yes, of course, when you have separation, the shear stress somewhere must vanish. But I'm saying that here the shear stress already vanished, but nothing happened.
Okay.
So the shear stress vanish is not the signal for separation. Okay. So this is how I define a T2. By the way, what was I talking about? I was talking about scaling. Okay, so now let's do triple deck. Anybody knows triple deck? Triple deck predicts this power, and after separation, triple deck doesn't work. That's what this picture is supposed to be. Now, what about Komogorov? So Komogorov predicts that the small scale is like square root, whatever, Reynolds number to the minus 3 quarters, right? And Komogorov seemed to be doing a good job. If you scale that, everything seemed to be, this is sort of a messy, this is why I'm saying this is an experimental result. Huh? No, I'm not talking about steady state. I'm not going to be talking about steady state. I'm always going to be talking about transient. And every indication seemed to be, for the data we have, the Komogorov is doing a much better job than triple deck or boundary layer prediction. So this is a suggestion that there is some sort of Komogorov scaling. Notice that over here it doesn't do a good job. The data is still going up. So now we plot this according to the Kato scaling. So what Kato predicted is that you have some Reynolds number to the minus 1. And that seems to do a much better job. So what I'd like to propose, with the limited amount of data we have, is to say that here you have boundary layer scaling, here you have Kato scaling, this is right around the blob, right around the separation time, you have Kato scaling, and here you have Komogorov scaling. And you can see that the evidence is limited, so I'm not going to study very, very hard on this. Okay, just a couple more things. This is the PDF of vorticity before separation. I'm plotting the maximum vorticity and scaled by various Reynolds number dependence as a function of time.
Okay. So is the maximum vorticity achieved on a small region? The separation times are you have a very rapid ejection mechanism that occurs on a small scale, and that's what you're plotting the
Kato
scale.
Yeah, precisely. The maximum vorticity almost always happens very close to the boundary, either at the boundary or next grid point of the boundary. So, pardon me? Everything is going to be transient, so I'm not going to talk about anything.
It's not a spectrum,
this is transient. So I'm only saying that after the separation that there is some Kato scaling. Afterwards, things seem to be described better.
The word scaling is drawing those boundaries. What you're saying is that the size and the physical scales
Yeah, that's actually my explanation, that you're expecting to have a shock formation, and if you work out the scaling for shocks, it is Reynolds number to the minus 1. If you didn't mention that, I forgot about that factor. The shocks are compressive.
Right.
Yeah.
But
pardon me? So usually we think of scaling of shear layers. But I'm saying that here there's some shock formation mechanism, and that gives the worst scale. Hmm? No, the Reynolds number is the Reynolds number. Cylinder size, impulse velocity from infinity, and the viscosity. How? Okay, so before I go on to the next thing, I just want to show you some pictures about PDF. So PDF for vorticity before scaling has one bump, strongly non-Gaussian, I would say. And after scale, after separation, has two bumps, has this two-modal, bimodal structure. Certainly, there's a lot to be, you know, studied. Huh? Yeah, here is everywhere. Yes. This is a vorticity everywhere in the computational domain. Yeah, it's all taken to it. It's all in here. The wake is also in here. Pardon me? No, this bump is the rather close to the cylinder. This bump here. This is probably the wake. This is probably the wake. Most of the time, places of vorticity are still small. That's this bump. But then you have this guy, which is the strong vorticity produced by the cylinder, by the separation. I am? My God. That's because you ask all these questions. Okay, just let me show you these nice pictures. I cannot go without showing these nice pictures. You can see that many separation events going on. There's this primary separation, but there are these other secondary, whatever, separations. Okay, so now I've only told you one thing that you might not have expected. And the second thing that you might not have expected is that there's a transition going on. Remember, I haven't answered my question whether it converges to Euler or Prandtl, right? So that's related to that. So if I showed you this picture I already put up, I've already explained what this is. This is the position of the on the cylinder where the shear stress vanishes at a smaller Reynolds number. It has this rather messy behavior. It looks very chaotic. Now, let me show you the same picture at higher Reynolds number. This is Reynolds number 100,000 and Reynolds number 50,000. What you see is that you have, oops, change the color. What you see is that you have a periodic shedding of vortices. The separation becomes much more regular than the lower Reynolds number. If you look at it, actually, there's a decoupling of this guy and these guys. These are the formation of the vortices at the cylinder. These are the vortices that have been taken away.
What is that frequency?
Frequency is roughly proportional. If you count, it's proportional to square root of Reynolds, roughly. So I'm going to show you some movies to show that there is a transition going on between these two Reynolds numbers. This is the shedding of vortices. So since I'm running out of time, I don't know whether I should show you the movies before or afterwards. Let me just show you the movie now. Oops, no signal. That's bad news. It was working before. No, it's not in VCR. It's in here. Before I just pushed and it worked. Okay, maybe show the movie later. But it seems like something's working. Okay, so what happens is that before, so I'm going to convince you there is a transition going on. Before this transition, which is I think roughly at 40K, this is not precisely verified now, this is not, that, pardon me? It's working now. What happens is that, okay, this is the first time I'm doing a high-tech talk. So what should I do? Play?
Yeah.
This is a 20K. This is below the separation. Is it? Nothing's happening, though. Huh?
I think it'll work.
Let's maybe do this later.
Yeah.
So let me explain to you. Okay, but I have to explain to you this, what the mechanism is. So what the transition happens is that at the lower Reynolds number, you have separation of boundary layer, but the boundary layer is not very turbulent. The boundary layer separates. The boundary layer separates, and it's been taken away very quickly by the wake. So you have separation and then turbulence happening. So separation happens before it becomes turbulent. At the higher Reynolds number, because the separation is decoupled from the formation of vortices, you have vortices forming at the cylinder, but they're still attached. But then, over here, at a much lower angle, it's been taken away. So you first have the formation of vortices, then you have separation. The implication of this is that if you look at the error between the viscous Navier-Stokes and the Euler, so this is the error plotted according to, say, the boundary layer scaling. If your boundary layer scaling works, we would expect that this guy goes to zero as Reynolds number to the minus quarters. Of course, before separation, something works, you know, it should work. It looks like, if you look at the lower Reynolds number, it looks like it's not working. The curve is not being, the curve is not collapsed. But after the separation, if you plot it again, it works. So what this suggesting is that from this transition process, the changes of the character of the separation makes it possible that there's still a convergence of Navier-Stokes to Euler. That's what all indications are. I'm sorry I didn't show you the details of the separation, but there are three movies that which I think you'll convince you that there is a transition. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Away from the bound. Mm-hmm. I'm just presenting all the evidence I have. I'm just presenting all the evidence I have. I don't. Certainly, I can. You know, I don't see why. Komarova's statement is simple. It's simply that suppose we have the dissipation rate and the viscosity. We want to make a length scale. That's a length scale. That's all. You don't need anything.
Is that because for last time when the Kolmogorov scaling became effective, you got transition already done and then turbulence?
That could be. I think the message I have here is that if you look at wall bond turbulence in 2D, it's probably more analogous to 3D than we thought. It certainly seems very different from the 2D isotropic turbulence. That's one of the messages that.
The other query I had was Jim asked this. The identification of T2.
Mm-hmm.
So T1 you take it to go with the primary separation, and T2 is taking it to the secondary separation?
No, I wouldn't even call T1 a primary separation. There's really nothing is separating. I mean, the Prandtl, you know, boundary layer theory still works very well. So I wouldn't call that. It's just, you know, shear stress vanishes. There is a backflow.
Yeah.
If I show the picture I showed you was blown up actually. So the radial direction is much bigger than it should be. It's a very tiny thin layer of backflow, teeny teeny thin layer. I've blown it up in the radial direction so that you can see.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to see.
Yeah.
That's all. Mm-hmm. But the epsilon in where?
In
No, the epsilon scale seems to only happen right at the separation. Yeah, and it's probably just the shock. And then, unless there's some other, I mean, it doesn't prevent the other separations going on. Actually, I showed you these little separation events. But there's so little, maybe we don't capture this, those.
Maybe it's more large.
There is I think it's a simpler problem with which you can probably use the same idea. We have the same sphere across the sphere. We have an X1 layer for essentially a shear layer on the bottom of this here. The layer collides until the region of jet comes out. Now, the numerical correction series is done to show that the shear layer itself.
This is the Ekman boundary layer now, right? Is this the Ekman layer or the same layer that we're talking about? If it's Ekman layer is a different problem.
It's a very similar case. Let me tell you what's going
on. Okay.
On the sphere, you have the case of one of the rainbows on top.
Yeah.
They collide and they go up.
Yeah.
And they are thicker than the original zone. It's actually one over four.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the exactly the same case.
Yeah.
And you can actually do an expansion. Orders of magnitude of porosity is exactly Reynolds number 2.5. You get the thickness that Reynolds number minus 1.4. I think it's very similar. You can actually justify this.
I have to think about it. Suddenly. Well, yeah, if it's only Ekman, I don't have enough time to think about what you just said. But so if it's an Ekman layer, yes, that's a different problem. You can show convergence, no problem. But if it's, it's proved. It's already proved. So anything's done, it's simple. PDF, yes. Okay, that's a hard question because I think we didn't look, but my guess would be very near the separation.
Yeah.
It's not just one angle, it's actually the whole region. Otherwise, it would not give this. Yeah. Near the surface, not just along the surface, near the whole, you know, sort of a separation region. I see. So you're saying the cylinder is different from other block bodies?
Yeah.
Okay, that's surprising to me. Okay. The Reynolds number is. That was Reynolds number rescaled, so. So it's roughly square root of Reynolds number. Yeah. Oh.